All right, well, after a week break, we're back to foreign policy in the Middle East and seeing whether it's biblical or not. So, I keep saying this, but next week should be the exciting week. So every week I keep saying that and it keeps getting put off. I mean, this is good information too, but next week, where I really wanted to go with this in the very beginning is what we'll cover next week, and I had to do all this other work to get up to that point. So today we're largely going to talk about what the Bible has to say about pacifism and self-defense and that kind of thing, and then we'll get into the non-aggression and non-intervention next time. But so we're going to look at today the fact that we have disregarded and forgotten the biblical position of non-intervention and non-aggression. I'm kind of like a mother now with eyes in the back of my
yes,
head.
You
I
are.
See him coming. So proponents, I'm going to look at what some other people would say that would be in favor of this idea of interventionism. Basically, intervention meaning to intervene in somebody else's affairs when you're not directly affected. And I'll define intervention here in a minute. But some of the proponents of interventionism and imperialism, that kind of foreign policy, they'll cite Old Testament examples, like where God commanded Israel to utterly destroy entire nations, mm-hmm. men, women, children, babies, animals, all of that. And they'll use those examples of how God commanded people to do that back in the Old Testament, commanded Israel to do that, and say that we are likewise, we're God's nation under the New Testament, don't you know, in the United States of America. We are the new Israel. And so we would be under a similar mandate from God to be able to do those kind of things because we need to, as George Bush said, to rid the world of evil since we are the noble and good nation out there. And I'm not making this up. I mean, I have argued with people, a guy I used to work with. I mean, we battled this one out quite a bit. So and when I say imperialism, I don't know if everybody knows what I'm talking about, but basically that's the idea of an empire where you're going out and spreading your tentacles abroad and controlling everything you can is kind of the government that we have. So there's a couple examples that I'll go to for this. Back in the book of Joshua, if you go to Joshua chapter 6, this is when Israel went and took over the city of Jericho and destroyed it. And God told them that they were to destroy everybody within Jericho. And if you look in Joshua 6:17, God said, we're going to read verse 17 and verse 21, Joshua 6. And the city shall be accursed, even it, and all that are therein to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all that are with her in her house, or in the house, because she hath hid the messengers that were sent, or that we sent. And if you remember what happened, Joshua sent spies into the land, or into Jericho. They went in there and they found the first stop was the harlot Rahab's house. And she hid them and told the men that were looking for them, oh, they went out another way, and they went out and shut the gate, and then she saved them. And because she saved them, they made a contract together, and they said that they would spare her and her family's lives, and she would put the scarlet rope or scarlet some type of material in the window anyway. When they saw that, they would spare her house. So in verse 21, and they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and ass with the edge of the sword. So they destroyed everybody. Man, woman, young, old, and even all the animals. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why God did those things. Some of those cities were so wicked that God knew that they would end up corrupting his people if they went and inhabited them. And so he commanded them just to completely and utterly destroy them because of that, so that they wouldn't have a corrupting influence on them. Another example of this would be in 1 Samuel 15. God told Saul, King Saul, this is many years later, long time later, hundreds of years later, told Saul to utterly destroy the Amalekites. 1 Samuel 15, verses 2 through 3. And as we remember, if you remember this account, Saul got himself into some trouble because he didn't quite do everything that God said. He kept some of the animals alive for himself to do sacrifice to the Lord. The people kind of talked him into it. And so... not always a good idea to listen to the people below you if they don't have good ideas. Would be a good lesson to learn from this. 1 Samuel 15, 2 through 3. Here's God's mandate to Saul and to Israel. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he had laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and smite Amalek and utterly destroy, utterly, that is completely, entirely destroy all that they have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass. That's even an infant and a suckling. I mean, we're talking about tiny little babies under 1 year old. Everybody was to be destroyed. Now people would take examples like this, how Israel was commanded just to go and wipe out people, and say that, well, we can, if they could do it, then we have a mandate from God to do that, to do racial cleansing, to get rid of these evil people in the world. We don't need them around. They're just a cancer on this earth. They'll say that God hasn't changed. The old, you know, the God that lived in the olden times is just the same today as we sing in the song. And they're right. They're absolutely right. God has not changed, not one bit. Look at Malachi 3:6. And it's a good thing. If God does change, or did change, imagine if he changed his mind whenever he says, oh, I'm going to save this little band of folks in the Minneapolis church, and then he sees how we all act sometimes, and he's like, no, I'm going to change my mind. I don't think so. They're going to hell now. So probably a good thing that God doesn't change. And actually, that's really not even a far-fetched example if you read what this verse says right here. Malachi 3:6, For I am the Lord, I change not, therefore ye sons of Jacob are not consumed. So I'm not just making that up. They would be consumed if God changed. How many times God wanted to destroy Israel whenever they came out of Egypt. How many times did he tell Moses, just Moses, get out of the way, I'm going to wipe them all out, and I'll make a new nation out of you, so technically I didn't break my promise. Because I was going to make a nation out of Israel, and you're still an Israelite, and I can make a new nation out of you. They had God pretty much at his wit's end, if that's possible for God to be at his wit's end, which it's, I guess that's kind of a stupid saying, because God can't be at his wit's end. There is no end to his wit. But you get what I'm saying. His patience was wearing thin. Hebrews 13, verse 8, familiar text says, Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. Hebrews 13 and verse 8. Yep, Jesus Christ the same yesterday and today and forever. So Jesus Christ is God. Jehovah says there in Malachi 3:6, he doesn't change. So they're right. People that are proponents of this imperialistic idea are right that God doesn't change. But they've missed something. Well, and they would say, and therefore, a Christian nation such as the USA would have such a mandate. What did they call it with the Indians? The manifest destiny? Mm-hmm. That we had this mandate to go wipe out these wicked people. Because people thought, they kind of looked at when we came over here as a Christian people, and here are these heathen, and they look at the parallel. They said, well, hey, Israel came out of Egypt. Mm-hmm. They went into a land uninhabited, found all these wicked people there. God tells them to destroy them. The pilgrims come over here, good, godly people. They find a land inhabited with a bunch of heathens. And, well, put two and two together, God must want us to wipe them out too. But where's the Bible for that? Now, while God hasn't changed, his law has. And that's the key to it. He hasn't changed, but his law has changed. And that is the important part. If you look at Hebrews 7, verse 12, I'm going to use a few verses here to prove this. This would be a great study someday, just to look at how the Old Testament was done away with and abolished, and the New Testament took its place, and then to see what parts of the Old Testament we are under now, and what parts we aren't. And that's an in-depth study. It's a very important study, and maybe someday, I'm sure someday, if I'm here long enough, we'll definitely get into that. And I hope I am here long enough. Hebrews 7 and verse 12 says, for the priesthood being changed, that's speaking of the Levitical priesthood being changed to the Melchizedek priesthood that Jesus holds, for the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law. So if Jesus is a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, and he is, verse 17, if the priesthood's changed, the law's changed also. Now, that's just it. That would be a ancillary proof, I guess. But there are just flat-out statements that said it's been done away with. Let's look at one better in Hebrews 8 and verse 13. This gets us a little bit closer. Hebrews 8:13. In that he saith, the new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. So here the old covenant is ready to vanish away. This is at the time of the writing of the book of Hebrews. And then we read in 1 Corinthians, or 2 Corinthians 3, if there's any doubt, and we looked at these verses, I think, two or three weeks ago, I believe it was. This just very plainly says that it's done away. 2 Corinthians 3, 6 through 13 says, "Who also hath made us able ministers of the New Testament, not of the letter, but of the Spirit? For the letter killeth, but the Spirit giveth life." So he's contrasting the New and the Old Testament. "But if the ministration of death," that's the Old Testament, "written and graven in stones," remember Moses got it off the mount, "was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not steadfastly behold the face of Moses for the glory of his countenance, which glory was to be done away." See, this was going to be done away. This was only a temporary thing. "How shall not the ministration of the Spirit be rather glorious?" That's the New Testament. "For if the ministration of condemnation be glory," that's the Old Testament, "much more doth the ministration of righteousness exceed in glory," New Testament. "For even that which was made glorious had no glory in this respect by reason of the glory that excelleth. For if that which is done away was glorious," that's the Old Testament, "it is done away, much more that which remaineth is glorious," the New Testament remains. "Seeing then that we have such hope, we use great plainness of speech, and not as Moses, which put a veil over his face, that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which is abolished." So that was a long reading, but I wanted to read the whole thing in context just so you can see. The Old Testament is done away. It is abolished. So if we don't have it repeated again in the New Testament, I mean, these mandates were given to Israel. These weren't even mandates just given to mankind in general that would still be binding on mankind in general. Now, they were given to Israel, to God's nation. If that's not repeated in the New Testament, we don't have a basis for doing it. And that goes not just with this study, with anything that is not, if it's not specifically repeated in the New Testament, and it wasn't a law that was given to mankind in general, that was still binding on mankind in general, we're not under that law. So that was a lot of verbiage there to prove the point, but I think I made it pretty well, I hope. Jesus showed that Old Testament precedents of this type have no natural application in the New Testament. See, this idea of just destroying people and killing people, just kind of flippantly, doesn't really have a parallel in the New Testament. And we see this with how Jesus responded to his disciples when they got a little bit excited and they wanted to do the same thing. They looked back, kind of like Christians nowadays do, and saw what an old prophet did to some people, and they said, "Oh, well, let's do the same thing." And Jesus said, "No." This is whenever they were going. Jesus was going through Samaria, and he was going to Jerusalem. It's in Luke 9:51 through 56. Luke 9:51 through 56. "And it came to pass, when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem." This is Jesus, so he's getting ready to go to Jerusalem, and he's set on it. He's going, and nobody's going to distract him. "And sent messengers before his face, and they went and entered into the village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. And they did not receive him, because his face was as though he would go to Jerusalem." They didn't really want anything to do with him. He doesn't look like he's not paying attention to us. He's got his sights set. They don't want anything to do with him. Well, the disciples get a little excited about this. "And when his disciples, James and John, saw this," John's the love disciple, don't you know? Read through the book of 1 John. He talks about love, love, love over and over again. Mm-hmm. He's the love disciple. "When they saw this, they said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elias did? But he turned and rebuked them and said, You know not what manner of spirit ye are of. For the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." Unless you're reading in NIV. And in NIV, that beginning there, "You know not what manner of spirit ye are of, for the Son of Man is not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." That's all gone. All omitted. So yeah, he apparently...
But he turned and rebuked them and said...
That's a good question. I don't know what is said before that. I just have the words underlined that are gone. So maybe it just said he turned and rebuked them, and then they went to another village. I'd have to look that up. I'm guessing it probably said he rebuked them, and then they went to another. I don't know. I'd have to look that up. But yeah, interesting. The NIV apparently doesn't think that Jesus was come to save them that are lost. So anyway, there's another one too. Speaking of which, let me look real quick. I think it's in Matthew 18. similar verse that's missing in the NIV. I just can't really help myself when it comes to bashing on the NIV, if I have any chance at all. Yeah, Matthew 18 and verse 11. Wow, this is, so they really knocked out two of them in this case. Matthew 18, 11, the whole verse is gone. For the Son of Man is come to save that which is lost, which was lost. Missing in the NIV. So, you know, just those unimportant things that really wasn't.
Lost verse.
Yeah, just didn't need to be there. I mean, the whole, even the number's gone, so they just skip right over the number and everything. It's great that the verses were numbered back, and I'm not sure if it was the Geneva Bible. Wait, it was the Bible prior to the King James is when they numbered the verses, because the verses weren't always numbered. Mm-hmm. You just had books. Basically, I don't think it was broken into chapters as far as I know. So you can imagine if you're having a Bible study back then, and I say, turn to Luke, somewhere in the middle. Or, what do you say? I don't know how you'd reference that. So that would be very difficult, but, anyway. It's great that the verses were numbered before these new versions came out, because otherwise they could have taken verses out and then did the numbering and you never know it. But now it was already numbered. They're not going to change all the numbering, so the numbering doesn't match the King James. So now the whole number's gone, and it's really obvious if you happen to be looking at the numbers as you're reading, like, wait a minute here, what's going on? I think that's funny.
It's like an NIV Bible quiz. I can't remember where I got it from. But basically, it has all these questions, you know, in such verse, what did Jesus say? Or, you know, turn, you know, write out exactly what does this verse. There's like 10 questions all to, and every one of them, they're all gone.
Yeah.
They're all from verses that are omitted or information in the verse that's omitted.
Nice.
It's classic.
That's awesome. I actually still have, I used to read the NIV, read the whole thing, and I still have 16 whole verses in the NIV memorized. I just stated all 16 of them. They're gone.
Yeah.
They don't say anything. They're missing. So anyway, those are the easy ones to remember. And that's probably about the most pure thing that book has to say is
right.
Nothing. So anyway, so Jesus said, you know, when they said, well, why don't we do as Elijah did and you know, call down fire from heaven on these people. Remember what happened with Elijah. The king sent 50 men to him to get him, and he calls down fire and destroys them all. The one guy runs back. He sends 50 more. He sends down fire and kills them. Send back 50 more, and then they finally realize, well, we're messing with somebody that's got some divine power here, and they said, hey, please don't kill us. And so they, if I'm telling the story right, I'm pretty sure that was how it went, without looking at it. But anyway, so Jesus was using this as I'm using this as an example of them saying, hey, we have a prophet in the Old Testament that killed people. Why don't we do it now? I mean, they're not receiving you. And he says, no, I'm not come to destroy men's lives. So anyway, you see the principle there, I hope.
Mm-hmm.
As was before proved, God's Israel under the New Testament is the church. And just go, if you're hearing only this part of the series, go back and listen to the first couple and you'll see that. Not the USA, not the United Kingdom, and even not the modern day nation of Israel. That's not Israel. Israel is the church. Israel is not any of those nations. So to say that the USA is the new Israel and that we have this manifest destiny to conquer other nations to create an imperial empire, I mean, where's the Bible for that?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any Bible for that. Since we're now under the New Testament, where in the New Testament does any country have a commandment from God to start aggressive wars with its neighbors? Show it to me. I mean, where is it at? Show me an example. Show me a commandment, a precept, an example, anything in the New Testament, which would even allude to the fact that God wants any nation, not just ours, out there starting wars of aggression. And I use my words carefully. Aggression. I'm not talking about self-defense. I'm talking about aggression. Unprovoked, non-self-defense wars. Where do we have this? For example, what if our government wanted to wage a war on Mexico? And the justification that we used is, hey, they're a bunch of Catholic, pagan, drug-running, drug cartel, just ravenous, murderous people down there. There's all this, I mean, crime going on, and they're just cutting people's faces off and sewing them to soccer balls and all kinds of stuff. I'm not even making that up. It actually goes on. I mean, just all kinds of terrible things. We just need to wipe them out. They're right on our border. They're coming over our border, and let's just go down there and just clean them out like Israel cleaned out the Canaanites, like they cleaned out the Amalekites. Okay, what basis in the New Testament, what commandment is there in the New Testament for us to do something like that? If you have some neocon Christian, George Bush, or whatever, give me a verse, New Testament, any precept, example, anything, that we would be in our rights to do that. anything. I don't see it. I mean, if you see it, you tell me. Seriously, but I don't see it. I can't see anything in here that would give us that right.
We would have a right to make a strong border and make a strong policy there, and if they violate it, that could be taken in aggression.
Absolutely.
But we haven't done that.
Right. No, we don't. I mean, yeah.
We have some diplomacy.
Pity little. No, absolutely not. And I don't want to get off on the immigration talks, but I think, I mean, if really the issue is our economy, the issue is not immigration. If we had a vibrant economy, we wouldn't care if they're coming over here and getting jobs, taking jobs that we don't want to take ourselves, picking fruit or whatever. We wouldn't. Why would we care? It just wouldn't matter. The issue becomes whenever our economy is poor and there are a lot of Americans out of work, and then you get resentment because they come over here and they're taking jobs under the table, not paying taxes. More power to them, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't bother me that anybody doesn't pay taxes, as far as I'm concerned. And I pay them, by the way, just so you know. I don't not pay my taxes. But anyway, I don't even want to get on immigration talks. That's not the purpose of the study. But you're absolutely right. God wants nations divided. Just to give you a verse for that, you're right. It's Acts 17. This idea of breaking down national boundaries and just having one big world government obviously is not God's plan. It's not what he wants. In Acts 17 and verse 26, it says, "And hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation." Now, why did God determine the bounds of their habitation beforehand? Read the next verse. "That they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us." It helps us to seek the Lord when nations are divided and you don't have one big conglomerate world government. That's why God wants nations divided, so that people can seek the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, I would see no justification for us going to Mexico or any other country. And I use Mexico just because it's even on our border, let alone a country 6,000 miles away on the other side of the pond that we have no business in at all. But even our neighbor like that, we wouldn't have a right to go racially cleanse them, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
So the New Testament counterpart. So you say, well, okay, so we got Old Testament examples of this. Those things were written for our admonitions. They were written for our learning, right? We have Romans 15 and 1 Corinthians 10 tell us that the Old Testament was written for us, that we can learn from it and be admonished by it. So what purpose is that? What are we supposed to learn from Joshua destroying Jericho, King Saul destroying Amalek? What do we learn from that? Well, here's the New Testament counterpart to it. The New Testament counterpart to these Old Testament commandments would be that Christians are to mortify the sins of the flesh and spare not any of them. So when they weren't to spare even the little ones, even the little babies, we don't even spare little sins.
Right.
We mortify, we kill all the sins of the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
Colossians 3, 5 through 9. See, there's spiritual parallels to these things. Colossians 3 and verse 5. Mortify, which means to kill. Mortify, therefore, your members which are upon the earth. That's not talking about your fellow members of the human race that are on the earth that you mortify. No. Mortify, therefore, your members which are on the earth, and I'll tell you what they are. Fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Notice he says mortify your members, not other people's members. Now, we're not killing other people that commit these things. Mortify yourself.
Right, right.
That's who you take care of. For which thing's sake the wrath of God cometh on the children of disobedience, in the which also ye walked some time when ye lived in them. But now ye also put off all these, anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication out of your mouth. Lie not one to another, seeing that ye have put off the old man with his deeds. So here's the counterpart. Mortify your members which are on the earth. Mortify your sin, and don't spare any of it. You see, the weapons of our warfare, the weapons of the church's warfare, are not carnal. Turn to 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 3 through 5. Now, there have been churches in the past, but the weapons of their warfare were carnal. The Catholic Church, they had carnal weapons. They had swords that they lopped people's heads off with and did all kinds of terrible things to people. Their weapons were carnal, but our weapons are not carnal. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 10:3, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. Look at those words there that he uses to describe our warfare. He uses words that happen in warfare. They pulling down, casting down, and bringing into captivity. But let me tell you something. We cast down imaginations, as this text says, not walls. We bring thoughts into captivity, not nations, not terrorists, not political dissidents. We bring thoughts into captivity. We mortify our own sins, not dictators we don't like. That's what we mortify. That's what we bring. That's what we cast down. That's what we bring into captivity. We don't bring quote terrorists to Guantanamo Bay and let them sit there and rot for the rest of their lives. Right. That's not the captivity that we bring in. We bring our own thoughts. We bring other people's thoughts into captivity by the power of persuasion, not by the power of the sword. Mm-hmm. That is the Christian's warfare. Now, non-intervention, don't get me wrong here. Non-intervention is not pacifism. Let me define the terms here. Non-intervention is absence of intervention in international politics, systematic non-interference by a nation in the affairs or of other nations, except where its own interests are directly involved. So, as you probably heard Ron Paul in the debates, when he talked about non-intervention, he wasn't talking about pacifism, and he wasn't talking about isolationism, and I will get into that. I don't think that'll probably be the first point next week, that non-intervention is not isolationism. But we see there that it's the absence of intervention unless your own interests are directly involved. And I'd be careful with that, your own interests are directly involved. The United States thinks it has interest all over the globe in everything. So if anybody does anything, it involves our interest, which should not be our interest. You know?
Right.
If we have an interest in oil, well, we have a thing called money and trading, and we can get oil if we want. And if we're the biggest buyer on the face of the earth, I guarantee you they're going to sell it to us. You know, and they're not going to be able to price gouge us or anything else. I mean, the market will work these things out. You don't need to work it out with bombs. You can work it out with diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what the founders said, too. That'll probably be in, like, two studies from now. I got a whole bunch of quotes from the founders and that kind of thing, too, on this whole topic.
And with the embassies everywhere, we have targets. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it becomes our interest because it seems like an embassy always blows up. And then all of a sudden, well, we have to do something because that is our interest now.
Yep.
And if any of that, some people have said that could be manufactured at times. And if that's the case, that needs to come out. And it's like, that doesn't count.
Well, those embassies, I mean, that's U.S. soil, too.
Right.
That's how, you know, like the embassy in Libya in Benghazi, that's U.S. soil. And when we got attacked there, which, you know, is what really happened and all that stuff. But anyway, that's an attack technically on U.S. soil. So, if you put an embassy in every country of people that hate us, just wait for them to attack it, and then we've been attacked, our embassies have been attacked.
Right.
You know, never mind the concept of blowback or anything like that. You go messing around other people's countries, and before you know it, they do attack you. I mean, if you see a hornet's nest and you stick your hand in it, you're probably going to get stung.
Right.
And then, oh, you wicked hornet, you stung me. Well, why'd you put your hand in the nest?
So non-interventionist nation wouldn't have embassies everywhere.
I would, or else they would just have embassies just simply for trading and commerce and just for peaceful relations, but they, I don't know, I mean, I'm trying to think, and I don't know my history that well, if we had embassies back in, you know, in the days that right after the revolution or not. I know we had friendly relations with a lot of countries in Europe, so I wouldn't say embassies would be wrong necessarily, but when you have embassies in countries that are your avowed enemies, you know, that just doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Brits had an embassy in Iran until just, I think it was the Brits just recently, and they withdrew them because of all the stuff that was going on over there. And so anyway. Pacifism, on the other hand, is the policy or doctrine of rejecting war and every form of violence, a violent action, as means of solving disputes, especially in international affairs. The belief in and advocacy of peaceful methods as feasible and desirable alternatives to war. So, I mean, everything in this definition is not bad. I mean, it is a good idea to try to have peaceful methods and peaceful alternatives to war. I mean, that's a good idea. Obviously, nobody wants to go to war. Well, no sane person wants to go to war anyway. There's a lot of people and a lot of politicians in this country that want to for some reason. But anyway, but you see here that this is the policy or doctrine of rejecting war in every form of violence as a means of solving disputes. And I'm not advocating that, and the Bible doesn't teach that. The Bible does teach that you can defend yourself. You have the right of self-defense, which would incur violence. You know, you could violently defend yourself if you've been attacked. So I'm not a pacifist, and I'm not a Mennonite or anything like that. I'm not advocating that. Now let's look at the fact that the Bible does not condemn soldiering or war in all circumstances. So, because some Christians are pacifists. I read an article by Philip Morrow that was posted on LouRockwell.com here a few weeks ago. Rather lengthy article. Forget what it was called. Shall We Smite with the Sword, I think what it was called. He was writing in World War I, and he was against war absolutely. In every type, in any case, he was against war, and I read his arguments, and I got some good stuff from it, but I just can't agree, and for the reasons which I will show here presently. So the Bible doesn't condemn soldiering and war in all circumstances. When soldiers came to John the Baptist to be baptized, he told them to be just, honest, and content, but he didn't tell them to forsake their profession as soldiers. Look in Luke 3:14. Some of these points that I'm making here are the exact same points that I made in the very first sermon I ever did way back in 2006, right at like less than a year after I was baptized and I came home on leave from Iraq, and Tim, Pastor Boffy, asked me if I wanted to do a sermon, and I did a sermon called Learning Biblical Principles in a Combat Zone, and this is one of the things that I talked about, so this is circling way back around to a long, long time ago for me. These aren't the same notes, and I have a bunch of additional points that I didn't see back then, too. So anyway, that's how it goes. You learn as you go. In Luke 3:14, people were coming to John the Baptist to be baptized, and some of the people that came to him were soldiers. And it says there in verse 14, "And the soldiers likewise demanded of him, saying, And what shall we do? And he said unto them, Quit your jobs and go get a real one." No, he didn't say that, did he? "And he said unto them, Do violence to no man, neither accuse any falsely, and be content with your wages." So, notice what he didn't. It's important of what he did tell them and what he didn't tell them. What he said and what he didn't say. And that's an important thing in Bible study, is to not only read what the verse says, but what it doesn't say. Because you can learn a lot from what it doesn't say. He didn't say, he could have said, and if it was wrong to be a soldier, would he not have said, if you need to repent to follow Christ, to be baptized, would he not have said, quit your job? What if a prostitute came to him? Would he say, be content with your wages? No, obviously not. You know, he wouldn't do that. He'd say, quit your sin. So when he didn't tell them to quit, that tells me there's nothing wrong with being a soldier.
Right.
Under certain circumstances. But he told them to do violence to no man, which, you know, soldiers, especially back then, that would be something that they would do. That's obviously not speaking of injuring somebody in war.
Right.
You know, you can't go to war without doing violence to somebody. That's speaking of not doing violence to somebody and extorting money from them, or just beating them up because you're a big, powerful soldier and you can, just being mean to people or whatever. Neither accuse any falsely, which would go into that, you know, hey, we can accuse you falsely, you haven't paid your taxes, you either give me $100 now or I'm going to kill you or drag you into the authorities or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. And be content with your wages. So I think all these things kind of go together, to be honest with you. Those three things sort of are all addressing the same problem. But anyway, so he didn't tell them to stop being soldiers. We had on at least two different occasions in the New Testament, you have centurions that were blessed on two different occasions. A centurion is the commander of a century in the Roman army. A century is a division of the Roman army constituting half of a maniple. I'm not sure what that is. Actually, half of a maniple is two centuries. I do know what it is. You didn't get it. It said a century constitutes half of a maniple.
Oh, terrible.
Okay, anyway, wow.
You guys are tired
tonight, apparently. And probably consisting originally of 100 men. So if you know the etymology of words, it's not surprising. Century is what, 100 years? A centipede has 100 legs, maybe, you know, something like that. It's got a bunch of them anyway.
Hundred cents make a dollar.
A hundred cents make a dollar, absolutely. And the metric measurement, centimeter, 100 centimeters in a meter. Centa meaning 100, okay. So anyway, a centurion was in charge of 100 soldiers. All right, so that's pretty easy to figure out. Now when a centurion came to Jesus and told him he was a centurion who was in authority over soldiers who obeyed his commands, Jesus didn't rebuke him for being in the military, but he rather commended him for his faith. Look in Luke 7, 1 through 9. Now, when I wanted to mention something, too, I forgot to mention back in Luke 3, those soldiers, there is some debate as to whether they were Jewish soldiers or Roman soldiers. I read the commentators on this thing, and I said that like that. I said that on purpose. Like that, actually, the commentators. Anyway, I really did, believe it or not. So, anyway, you're making me lose my train of thought now. Commentators, yeah. Oh, Luke 3, yeah. You guys are terrible. So, anyway... Some of them said that they were probably Roman soldiers. Some of them said that they were Jewish soldiers in the Roman army. I don't believe for a minute they were Roman soldiers. They may have been Jewish soldiers in the Roman army. I don't believe they were Roman soldiers. They were coming to be baptized. And the Bible is clear. The first Gentile that was baptized was Cornelius. So yep. I don't buy that they were Roman soldiers at all. And none of the commentators mentioned that. And I was kind of surprised because obviously they're a lot smarter than me. And But and another thing that they didn't mention, at least that I didn't see, is they could have been Jewish soldiers not in the Roman army, I think, too. They had temple guards. They had Judas brought a band to get Christ. A band is a group of soldiers. So I don't know. I don't know the history back then that well to know if there were Jewish soldiers that weren't in the Roman Empire. And some people didn't think they were Jewish soldiers in the Roman army because why would Rome have soldiers of Jewish extraction in Judea? In Israel,
right.
You know, so I mean, they might be end up being traitors or something. So I don't know. The fact is, I'm certain they weren't Roman soldiers. They were probably Jewish soldiers, and they could have been Jewish soldiers in a Jewish army, as far as I'm concerned. So anyway, regardless, that's not exactly important, but I just wanted to mention that. Mm-hmm. In Luke 7, 1 through, 1 through 9? 1 through 9. Here's a centurion that comes to Jesus, and he said that he was a man under authority. I don't think I'm going to read the whole thing, but I think if you remember it, he said he had soldiers under him. He said to one, go, and they go. Come, and he comes. And he tells a servant to do this, and he does it in verse 8. And Jesus said, in response to that, that he hadn't seen so great a faith, no, not in all Israel. So far from rebuking him for being a centurion, a soldier, a commander a company commander, basically, would have been today's equivalent. Far from rebuking him for that, he blessed him and said he hadn't seen so great a faith, no, not in all of Israel. So anyway, there's your second example of a soldier that was not rebuked for the fact of being a soldier. Here's a third example. Cornelius was a centurion in the Italian band. Remember that in Acts chapter 10. Here's a devout man that feared God, prayed to God always. It says there in verse 2, a devout man, one that feared God with all his house and gave much alms to the people and prayed to God always. Far from rebuking him, God heard his prayers and then sent a preacher there to preach him and baptize him. And one of the conditions of his baptism wasn't changing his job. Mm-hmm. You look in Acts 10:48, Peter said nothing about him forsaking being a soldier or anything like that. In verse 48, and he commanded them to be baptized in the name of the Lord, then prayed they him to tarry certain days. So, once again, there's another third example of a soldier who was not told he had to forsake his soldiering or anything to follow Christ or anything like that. Ministers are referred to as soldiers. Now, I'm going somewhere with this. I want to make a point from that. In Philippians 2 and verse 25. I'll just establish this and then I'll draw out the point from it. Philippians 2:25 says, Paul says, Yet I supposed it necessary to send to you Epaphroditus, my brother and companion in labor and fellow soldier, but your messenger, and he that ministered to my wants. So Paul calls this preacher a fellow soldier. Preachers are called soldiers. Paul even describes ministers as soldiers that war. They go a warring in 2 Timothy, in verse 2 Timothy chapter 2, and verse 2 through 3. 2 Timothy 2, 2 through 3. Second Timothy 2:2-3. In the things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men who shall be able to teach others also. Thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who hath chosen him to be a soldier. Paul's writing to a young minister, Timothy, says he's a soldier. And that verse right there is why I don't, and I try not to clutter my life up with a bunch of unnecessary things, why I try to live simply in an apartment and stay out of debt, and why I'm not married and everything else. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I'm a soldier, I'm warring, and I don't want to entangle myself in the affairs of this life and distract me from what God's called me to do. And so that's why I do these things, one of the reasons. But anyway, here Paul describes a minister as a soldier and even says that they war, that no man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life. Now, if it was sinful to be a soldier and go to war, then God certainly wouldn't use that terminology to describe his ministers, would he? Would God use terminology? Would Paul say, endure hardness as a good prostitute of Jesus Christ? As a good fornicator of Jesus Christ? I mean, would he say that? Would he use some profession, if you can call it that, that is sinful in nature, to liken his ministers to? Obviously not. I mean, that wouldn't make any sense at all. So he wouldn't use something sinful to use as a description of the ministry. The Bible uses the principles of war making for illustrations also. Jesus used the principle of war making to illustrate the importance of counting the cost of discipleship in Luke 14:31-33. Jesus said, he's giving people examples, practical examples of counting the cost before you go plunge into something headlong to see if you really want to do this. I like Jesus' altar calls. He invites people to leave. He invites people to count the cost and see if you can somehow figure out a way where this is too difficult and you shouldn't do it. You know, he doesn't tell you to, he doesn't want you to jump into it if you're not ready to commit. And what king going to make a war against another king sitteth not down first and consulteth whether he be able with 10,000 to meet him that cometh against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is yet a great way off, he sendeth an ambassage and desireth conditions of peace. So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsaketh not all that he hath, he cannot be my disciple. See, he likens discipleship to a king going to war with another king and seeing if he has enough soldiers to take on this other king. So my point here is that if it was sinful to be a soldier and to go to war, then God certainly wouldn't use that terminology to describe discipleship, to describe going into the ministry, anything like that. It wouldn't make any sense. Paul uses the principle of war making to illustrate the fact that a minister ought to be paid for his labor. Here's another one. In 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 7, it's just interesting of how many things that he uses illustrations from war about practical life. Here's at least the third one that I found. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 7. It says, who goeth a warfare any time at his own charges? Who planteth a vineyard and not eateth the fruit thereof? Who feedeth the flock and eateth not the milk thereof? So, I mean, it's a valid point. Who goes to warfare? What soldier goes off to war and pays his own way? Pays his own airfare, pays for his own weapon, pays for his own rations? Nobody does that. I mean, somebody pays him to do that. And likewise, Paul says, they that preach the gospel live of the gospel. He doesn't go to warfare at his own charges. That's why you guys support me as your minister, so I can go back and study the Word, and I don't have to be out there working full time. You know, I can do the work of the ministry. And Paul uses an example of war making for that example. So, you know, once again, if it was wrong to go to war at any, for any reason, he wouldn't use that as an illustration of supporting the ministry. That makes sense? Now, the Bible allows for and promotes self-defense. And I think this is important. This is very important because there are a lot of people that take verses, and we'll look at a few of them, and they use verses, turn the other cheek and that kind of thing, to say that we should never resist not evil, you never physically or violently resist anybody for any reason. And that's a position that the Bible does not teach, does not take. The Bible, although it promotes self-defense, most wars, though, are not in self-defense. They're rather the product of the lust of men over power, control, or resources, or whatever. If you look in James 4, 1 through 2, this is a bit of an extrapolation, because James is talking to believers, individual believers here, but the principle holds fast of what causes wars. He says there in James 4, 1 through 2, from whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lust that war in your members? Ye lust and ye have not, ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. Ye fight in war, yet ye have not because ye ask not. I mean, does that not describe our foreign policy and most foreign policies of most countries over the years? Why do nations go to war? They lust. They want more land. They want more resources. They want take over people. They just want the power. They want whatever. But it's something. It's always a lust within them. It's not some noble cause, usually. I mean, I would be hard-pressed to find a war that was fought for noble causes. I mean, they just don't happen very often. We're always told about the noble causes, you know, and the good reasons for them, of course. I mean, you gotta propaganda to sell this stuff to people. But in reality, not the case. Now, Jesus commanded his disciples to be armed with a sword, and even to sell their garment and buy one if you don't have one. There's a guy I know that has a Glock 36 that has engraved right on the slide, Luke 22:36, and then it says, "He engraved, he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one." Pretty cool. I'll have to show it to you sometime. Kind of tip my hat, I guess, who the guy was. But anyway, in Luke 22:36, Jesus said, so Jesus had sent the disciples out prior to this, and he sent them out. They didn't take anything with them. No purse, no script, no food. Just go out, go into the first house you find. They'll feed you. If they don't receive you, shake the dust off your feet and go to the next house. But don't worry about yourselves. You'll be taken care of. But things have changed now. Jesus is getting ready to depart, and things are going to be different. And he says in verse 36, then said he unto them, but now he that hath a purse, let him take it, and likewise his scrip, which is his bag. And he that hath no sword, let him sell his garment and buy one. So not only does Jesus tell them to have a sword and to be armed with a sword, which at that time would have been the equivalent of a AK-47 right, or whatever. I mean, that was the weapon of the day. That was it. I mean, so you had a sword, you had what the military had. I mean, you had the deal. So what people will say is he was talking about a spiritual sword. He was not talking about a spiritual sword, as I will show here. When the disciples presented two swords, what did he say? Look in verse 38. And they said, Lord, behold, here are two swords. And he said unto them, not those kind of swords, a spiritual sword, dummy. He didn't say that, did he? He said, it is enough. Here are two swords these guys were carrying. I mean, they were packing. They had swords with them. He says, it is enough. Two swords is enough. It's not talking about a spiritual sword. And the lesson that I take from this is it's enough to carry two guns. I mean, what kind of a wacko carries three guns on him? I mean, two guns is plenty to be carrying on you at one time.
It is enough.
You know, I mean, I would say it's enough. You know, and as an old professor that I had in networking said, if you don't have two, you don't have any. So, redundancy. You know, I think it's a good idea. But anyway, not to be radical or anything. And no, I don't have two guns on me right now. Jesus said that a strong man armed keeps his house in peace. Look at how Jesus upholds this idea of self-defense. in Luke 11:21. These verses, you read right over them and you wouldn't even think about it. You try to think of verses in the Bible that support self-defense, you'd read right over this, you wouldn't even think about it. I got a couple of them in here that, by the way, I did not find. Other people have found, and that I've gleaned from them, which, you know, obviously, I'm sure none of us in the last 1900 years are the first ones to find anything, right? I mean, everybody's found them before at some point. But anyway, in Luke 11 and verse 21, Jesus said, "When a strong man armed keepeth his palace, his goods are in peace. But when a stronger than he shall come unto him and overcome him, he taketh from him all his armor wherein he trusted and divideth his spoils." Look what he says there. When a strong man armed keepeth his palace, his goods are in peace. He's upholding the idea of self-defense. A strong man who's armed keeps his goods in peace. You're protecting your property. You're protecting your life. You're protecting your possessions in your house. When you're armed, you keep your goods in peace. But then when a stronger than he comes, overcomes him, takes away all his armor wherein he trusted. That's what you call government gun control.
That's right.
You know, a stronger than you takes away your armor wherein you trusted and plunders you. That's government gun control right there. Yep. But right here, Jesus is upholding self-defense. He's using this example as an example in the kingdom of God. A strong man armed keepeth his palace. There's certainly nothing wrong with that. He said in Matthew 24:43, that the good man of the house would not suffer his house to be broken up. Matthew 24 and verse 43. He says here, let's get verse 42. "Watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come." He's talking about the second coming. "But know this, that if the good man of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched and would not have suffered his house to be broken up." Or you could say broken into in today's language. Look at what he's... So a good man is the master or the male head of a house. That's like you, Jason. You're you and Steve, you guys are the good men of the house. "He would not suffer," which means to tolerate or allow. So the master of the house isn't going to allow somebody to break up his house. He's not going to allow him. How are you not going to allow him? Obviously, you're going to resist him, right? You're not going to call 911 or something like that. You're going to resist him. "A strong man armed keepeth his palace." Mm-hmm. His goods are in peace.
Right.
Jesus said, he likens that to the second coming. Watch, pay attention. Don't let the thief take you unawares. Be ready for him. And if you compare that with Exodus 22:2, this is basically exactly what Jesus is talking about here. This is a law under this is what would be modern day castle doctrine, back in the law of Moses. It says there in verse 22, Exodus 22:2, "If a thief be found breaking up and be smitten that he die, there shall be no blood be shed for him." So if a thief breaks into your house, and I believe this was at night, "if the sun be risen upon him, there shall blood be shed for him." So I'm pretty sure I'd have to look at this, but if it was at night, somebody breaks into your house at night, you kill him, no blood shed for him, no punishment whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
God certainly upholds the castle doctrine where you can defend your own property, even killing somebody if they break into your house to try to rob you or harm you or something like that, especially if it's at night. So anyway, God upholds both testament, this idea of self-defense. Now, on the other hand, retaliation is not self-defense, and it must not be done. It's God's place to recompense, to repay, not ours. Bible's pretty clear about this. In Romans 12:17-21, there's a big difference between defending your property, defending yourself against an intruder, and going to that intruder's house after he's stolen something and killing him. Big difference in that. In Romans 12:17-21, Paul said, "Recompense to no man evil for evil, provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. For in so doing, thou shalt heap coals of fire upon his head. Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good." So we don't recompense. We don't avenge our enemies. God does that. You give that to God, and you let him deal with the enemies. You let him deal with them. Proverbs 24:29 speaks to this as well. Proverbs 24:29. This is a New and Old Testament principle, both. 24:29, say not, I will do so to him as he hath done to me. I will render to the man according to his work. Don't say that. I'm not he. He hit me, I'm going to hit him back. He stole from me, I'm going to steal back from him. He killed my family member, I'm going to go kill his. It's not how it works. Vengeance is God's. He'll repay. Now, if you catch him in the act of trying to kill you or trying to kill your family or trying to steal from you, that's a different story. You can defend yourself. After the fact, you don't recompense. We ought not to render evil for evil. 1 Peter 3 and verse 9. This is where Christianity gets difficult because our flesh says, oh, I want to get him back.
Right.
You know, payback's a you-know-what.
Yep.
That's what we say, but that's not what God says. That's the difference. 1 Peter 3 and verse 9. Not rendering evil for evil or railing for railing, but contrariwise blessing, knowing that ye are there unto called, that ye should inherit a blessing. We don't render railing for railing or evil for evil. That's not how we do it. We bless them that curse us. And pray for them to despitefully use us and persecute us, as Jesus said in Matthew 5. Proverbs 20 and verse 22. And it's not unreasonable, because as I will get into in just a minute, we are following exactly what Jesus did. We're following his example. So God's not telling us something to do that he himself wouldn't do. In Proverbs 20 and verse 22, say not thou, I will recompense evil, but wait on the Lord, and he shall save thee. Don't recompense evil. I think this is important for the kids, too. If your brother teases you, do you tease him back? If your brother hits you, do you hit him back? If your brother takes your toy, do you take it back? You know, you go steal his. I mean, you don't, that's something that kids are all the time doing. You know, they recompense evil for evil and railing for railing. And he did it to me first. How many times have you heard that? That's not what God says to do.
Even married couples do that sometimes.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
That's self-defense. Don't get into that. We just covered that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing. If somebody comes up, you know, if you're on the playground and some bully comes up and punches you in the face or something and he's trying to pummel you, that's a different story. But if he as I'm going to get into in just a second, if he slaps you, and you're not, your life isn't in danger or something like that, then yeah, you shouldn't be hitting back and rendering evil for evil and railing for railing. There's a time to defend oneself. Or I'm sorry, there's a time to not defend oneself. There's little words in there. There is a time to defend yourself too. I was already talked about that. There's a time to not, see that's why I like extemporaneous, but I just throw the stupid outline away. But anyway, then I probably forget some of the things I wanted to say. There's a time to not defend yourself. If you're being persecuted for the gospel's sake, like Jesus, we should not resist with violence. And that's one of the key things, where when do we resist, when do we not? When do we defend ourselves? If you're being persecuted for righteousness' sake, I would say do not resist. If somebody's coming after you because you're a Christian and because of a belief you hold, even if it's the government or whatever, don't mow them down with an AK when they're coming to your door to persecute you for your faith. You know, that's not what Jesus did. You know, not at all. Even if he had an AK, he wouldn't have done that. He had 12 legions of angels. You know, that's not what he did, and that's not what we should do either. How many Christians, though, oh, they come to get me, you know, that's not what we should do. Now, it's a different story if, I don't know, there'd be lots of examples of that. If somebody's just coming after you to rob you or to kill you, or even if it is some kind of a police officer or something else, I mean, that's a different story. But if they're persecuting you for your faith, I would not do that. 1 Peter 2:19-23. And if it is some powerful entity like that, I mean, it's obviously a suicide mission anyway. I mean, you're not going to win. You're going to die anyway. So it's, you know, maybe you're going down for a cause or something like that. I wouldn't necessarily fault you for that. But anyway, 1 Peter 2:19-23. For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God suffer grief or endure grief suffering wrongfully. For what glory is it if, when you be buffeted for your faults, you take it patiently? Well, if you did something to deserve it, and you're getting persecuted for it, you're getting beaten for it, yeah, I mean, God's not going to look down on you and say, well done, thou good and faithful servant, you are enduring persecution. No, you deserve it. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, well done, you took that spanking well. Good job, boy. No, I mean, I'm not going to praise you for that, you deserved it. Now, if you got a spanking when it was your brother that did something and you got thrown under the bus, then, you know, maybe you get praised for getting a beating when you didn't do it or something like that. But anyway. Let's see. For what glory is it when you be buffeted for your faults? You shall take it patiently. But if, when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. For even hereunto were ye called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that ye should follow his steps, who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth, who when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. I mean, you can just imagine that. There's the only sinless person that ever lived. He truly did nothing wrong, ever. And here people are reviling him, wagging their heads at him, mocking him. If thou be Christ, come down off the cross. They smash a plate of crown of thorns on his head and mock him, put a purple robe on him, bow down, put a reed in his hand. All these terrible things. Didn't do anything wrong, and yet he didn't lash back at him. He didn't say, oh, you wait, you got something coming to you. Nothing. He could have, right? I mean, he easily could have. He could have zapped him with a bolt of lightning instantly. I mean, but he didn't. He didn't rail back. He didn't talk back to them. He suffered it patiently, and he left for us an example to do likewise. We should not resist minor offenses with violence. So we should not use violence to resist minor offenses. This is a very misunderstood passage, and I hope I can do it some justice here in a few minutes. In Matthew 5:39 through 41, this is the Sermon on the Mount. And some people take these words to mean that you should never resist evil at all, no matter what. Jesus said, let's get verse 38 to get some context. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say unto you that you resist not evil. But whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him take thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain. Give to him that asketh thee, and of him that would borrow of thee, turn not thou away. So he says, if somebody smites you, if somebody slaps you on the right cheek, give him the left. Somebody whacks you, just say, go ahead, hit me again. Give him the left. What would a guy feel like that? You get into a fight and somebody just loses their temper and they slap you, or your wife slaps you, and you just turn and say, slap me on the other side too. I mean, what's that going to do? You know, maybe she's just really mad, she'll belt you again, but, you know, I mean, what's that going to do, though? I mean, that's heaping coals of fire on her head, right? On his head, or whoever it is. If somebody takes you to court to sue you for your coat, give them your cloak, which is another overgarment. Just looked that up in the dictionary today. You know, minor stuff. Somebody slaps you. They're not trying to kill you. They slap you in the face. Take it patiently. They take your coat. All right, you know what? If it's worth that much to you, take my cloak also. You know, you're going to sue me over something stupid here. Just take it. I don't even care about it. It's not even worth fighting over. If somebody compels you and forces you to go to a mile, go too. You didn't say if they're trying to drag you behind the back of a pickup truck for 10 miles or something. You know, I mean, he's not talking about things like that. He's talking about minor offenses. It's a far cry different than if somebody takes a machete and lops off your left arm and you say, well, go ahead and cut my right arm off too. You know, somebody rapes my first daughter and you say, well, go ahead and do the second one too. Obviously, that's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about minor things. The Pharisees were big on the letter of the law, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. You slap me, I slap you. You say something mean to me, I say something mean to you. I mean, just big on the letter of the law. No spirit of the law within them. And Jesus says, resist not evil. Don't make a big deal out of nothing. If you don't provide for the preservation of your family's life, then you've denied the faith. So, there is a time, you know, like I said, a minor offense, no big deal. somebody comes to kill your family member and you say, well, Jesus said resist not evil. Sorry, honey. No, if you don't provide for your family, you're worse than an infidel. You deny the faith. This is speaking of providing monetarily, but I mean, the most basic necessity is life itself. If you don't provide for life and safety and security and that kind of thing, you've denied the faith. 1 Timothy 5:18 or 5:8. But if any provide not for his own, and especially for his own, for those of his own house, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. So any man who sees his wife being beaten up and says, oh, Jesus said to resist not evil, you've denied the faith. And we would certainly put you out of the church in short order. Absolutely. And a man, and lastly, a man with discretion will defer his anger. Proverbs 19 and verse 11. Proverbs 19 in verse 11, the discretion of a man deferreth his anger, and it is his glory to pass over a transgression. Resist not evil. No big transgression. Somebody slaps you. It's your glory to pass over it. You know, it's just don't make a big deal out of nothing. So there's a time to defend yourself. You know, you won't suffer your house to be broken up. You keep your goods in peace. An armed man keeps his goods in peace. There's also a time to not defend yourself when you're being persecuted for the faith or that kind of thing. So what's this have to do with foreign policy? Well, what I wanted to do is establish the fact that self-defense is not wrong. So pacifism to say that it's always wrong to resist evil is not a correct position. Non-intervention is not pacifism. So now that I've shown it's not wrong to resist, so, and I'm going to show next time, things that apply, some things at least that apply to individuals also apply to nations. So we are, as individuals, allowed to defend ourselves. We, as nations, are allowed to defend ourselves when we are attacked. And I'm going to get into all that next time. But this has pretty well laid the foundation to then talk about non-interventionism. So I hope that was beneficial. Next time, we should get into the fun stuff, I think. I mean, maybe this was fun, too. I hope it was. But next time, we should get into some real good stuff, hopefully.